We're exploring what psychology says about TV binge watching. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. Friends and The Office are two of Netflix's most watched shows. Friends has been off the air for over 15 years, but the NBC sitcom still holds a special place in the hearts of many fans, like this moment with the character Joey.
Where is the waitress? I'm starving. It's a buffet, man.
Oh, here's where I win all my money back.
Netflix recently announced it'll no longer stream the show after its contract expires. So some fans have taken to binge-watching the entire series before it leaves Netflix for good. And so we want to know, what does binge-watching do to our brains? Do you binge-watch shows or entire seasons? What are your favorites? Do you re-watch shows or explore new ones? We're at 800-642-1234. Ben Rader is a clinical psychologist in Milwaukee and the public education coordinator for the Wisconsin Psychological Association, and he joins us from our Milwaukee studios. Ben, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, great. Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So when did binge-watching come onto our radar? Well, you know, when did we start doing this?
Well, I think this is something that we can really think now how we're consuming television in a much different way because of Netflix and so forth. I mean, it's right there at our fingertips, isn't it? You can just watch one more episode, and after all, it's only 20 minutes without the question, without the commercial. So it's something that's maybe a phenomenon now. It's just because of how we are able to access whatever we want whenever we want it.
Consumption just becomes so easy when one episode starts right after the last one finishes. What happens in our brains when we watch shows for long periods of time?
Well, you know, certainly the maybe the amount of time is relative, but the more you kind of enter into a monotonous routine, and particularly when you're watching any screen time, the impact on the brain can reset our sleep-wake cycle. It can certainly impact upon our ability to kind of focus and attend to things outside of that. And it doesn't necessarily bode very well for productivity in our lives outside of the series or program whatever we're watching.
What might it do to our relationships?
Well, certainly it depends on circumstance, too. Many of us find that binge watching is something that we do with other people. So, you know, if you may be at home and you're there with individuals, and there may be some positive benefits where you're just able to steal another 20 minutes or whatever it is with one another. And to kind of enjoy something together. But if you're kind of watching more in an isolative manner, it almost pulls you further away from those around us and keeps you kind of locked into the spell cast on us by that flashing screen.
We're talking about what happens when we binge watch TV. Clinical psychologist Ben Rader is with us. You can join in. Have you noticed that watching too much TV has impacted your health or the health of someone you know? What changes have you seen? Has binge watching shows impacted your social life, perhaps your personal relationships? Join in with your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234. So, Ben, a psychologist in the UK recently said that watching certain shows can actually help with coping with anxiety. And he gave the example of Friends, when you often, you know, get to see relationship issues get resolved within the course of an episode. Can watching TV at all be good for us?
Yeah, I really particularly like that that finding the research, and I think it's something that we really need to kind of think about differently. Anytime you use the term binge watching, which I connotes something negative in general, we use that language descriptively when we're talking about certain mental health conditions, particularly around food consumption, however, or alcohol consumption. However, if we're really looking at what's happening when we're watching a show or a program, we're really attempting to understand ourselves in social experiences. So watching, in particularly a comedy, we're often looking for the good in ourselves, or being able to find through the characters some hope or resolution perhaps for things that are going on in our own experience, or maybe just escape from it.
From a clinical standpoint, is there a definition of what binging is? Like, how much TV is this?
Well, this is certainly not a very clinical use of the term at this point. We're referencing, I think, language now in the popular media that's being applied to television and other forms of consuming entertainment, which has in the past really been applied to eating or consuming of substances. So there isn't really a benchmark right now, a clinical benchmark for what is considered a binging. For me, and kind of in a professional role that I'll serve, is binging maybe anything that is perceived to be excessive or breaks a normal routine that the individual has been able to establish in work and socialization and so forth, and has impeded upon that onto that routine to the point that it's become somehow disruptive. So, in a sense, that individuals using the term binging, it suggests almost implicitly that it's a problem.
Yeah, and so it crosses a line from being something that you perhaps are enjoying taking in to something that may be more compulsive.
Yeah, that's right. And something that maybe a part of you, even as you're enjoying it, is also realizing that this is something that, okay, now this is too much.
So the psychologist also was looking at the Big Bang Theory and referenced that as a program in relation to anxiety.
What's his problem?
His imaginary girlfriend broke up with him.
Been there.
The voice of Sheldon there. And it's hard not to laugh. I mean, can we make that inference there between watching some of these shows and what it can do to our anxiety level?
Sure, certainly. And I feel like having that escape, again, and the ability for an individual just kind of maybe tune out for a moment of the stressors and the challenges that we have in our day-to-day life certainly can have a positive effect. Now imagine any other form of entertainment, going to a play or having some time, stealing 2 hours or so watching a movie. During that time, we can find an individual who's maybe previously stressed out about work and family and everything has now just entered into this terrain of complete escapism. And our brain can somewhat reset how it's functioning in that time period. We're going to find that our blood pressure may go back to normal ranges, and that the things that seem to be preoccupying us at that point in time, and right as we started engaging and watching the program, now kind of just drift away, and it allows us to enter into more open, curious, funny frame of mind, and almost one where we're deciding to be relaxed.
We're talking about binge-watching TV, what it does to our health, with clinical psychologist Ben Rader as our guide. When you're binge-watching, how closely are you following episodes? Or do you put it on in the background while doing something else? Has binge-watching impacted your social life, perhaps your relationships? Or maybe you've never watched TV shows back-to-back? Join in with your observations, your questions. Welcome, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about what happens when we binge watch TV. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the next couple years, Netflix will lose The Office, it'll lose Friends, it'll lose its Disney catalog. And according to streaming observer, Netflix users watch about 5 5 billion hours of content on the streaming service each month. So to break down this binge watching, to watch every episode of Grey's Anatomy, it would take about 14 days. Friends, about 5 days. The Big Bang Theory, 5 days, 19 hours, 30 minutes. It's science, so we can be precise. All of the courtesy there of Binge Clock, and it's a tool that allows you to calculate how much time it'll take you to watch a show. So how does binge watching make you feel? Do you feel less stressed when you do it? Do you feel that you feel good while you're actually watching and then don't feel so good afterward? Join in 800-642-1234. And clinical psychologist Ben Rader is helping us sort through binge watching. He stays with us. So, Ben, when is binge watching considered unhealthy? Is there a measurement tool there?
Well, there's not a measurement tool per se now that's being used and applied. I think in my private practice, if somebody's talking about it disrupting the quality of their life or their relationship, somebody's complaining about how much television somebody's watching and they're pulling away from another in a relationship, you know, those are certainly good examples. I usually like to look at the three kind of areas of life in terms of socialization and being social and active out in the world and in work and family. And where does watching television really fit? And is you kind of maybe a binge watching at work that certainly can get you into some sort of trouble, or if your whole family time now together is kind of consumed by watching when you would normally be together with the family and connecting with others in your home, that could be problematic. And I believe that any time you're watching things repetitively and for a long period of time, if that's not something that wasn't really scheduled use of your time, if that was somehow a deviation from what normally happens, it can get you into trouble.
Yeah, and so when we sit the toddler down in front of the TV, you know, for hours at a time, maybe not such a great idea there. Let's look at what it can do to sleep. A 2017 study revealed that avid binge watchers can have poor sleep, increased fatigue, insomnia symptoms. Do you see this at all? And what are some symptoms there?
Sure. You know, the circadian rhythm can be impacted by the screen time. And in fact, most sleep hygienists, people who study what it takes to be healthy in sleep, will actually discourage not even having a television in your bedroom or in the space where you're sleeping, just because it can really impact upon your the way that your natural sleep-wake cycle operates. As that, and particularly if you're watching the idea of you're watching television, maybe at a time that your body's should already be asleep, that you're interrupting the normal sleep cycle quite directly because your body should be resting and now it's awake. But even just watching television up until the point of sleep can kind of confuse how your brain's expecting experience the sleep-wake cycle and maybe keep you up a little bit longer than what you would have if you'd maybe turned it off an hour or so beforehand.
Yeah, the CEO of Netflix said a couple years ago, you get a show or a movie you're really dying to watch, he said, and you end up staying up late at night. So he said, we actually compete with sleep and we're winning.
Right. That's quite an admission there.
Yeah. There's a study out of the UK in the journal Scientific Reports suggesting that binge watching TV could slow down our thought process when we get older. And the researchers said some preliminary results indicate TV viewing for more than 3.5 hours a day is related to cognitive decline. What do we know there?
Well, again, this is a pretty an emerging study. So what do we think is happening? I feel that we're kind of resetting how our brain operates. And if you think of something that you do for 3 hours a day, I mean, what else do we really do 3 hours a day? Think of it in a positive way. Imagine if you exercise for 3 hours a day. We would expect that to have some considerable impact upon our immediate health and wellness. But If you're overdoing it, that also would have a negative impact upon your joints. And we know professional athletes often have difficulties later on in life, physical problems with joints and so forth. So because we can overdo it. I guess since we're watching television, you think you're really not doing anything at all. But if you're programming 3 hours out of a 24-hour day to be kind of a passive and to taking in information in a way that's that isn't all that engaged or active, that certainly could set a pattern of brain function that long-term now has longer-term consequences.
And then there's the food consumption while on the couch and not even really thinking about what you're eating.
Right. And you think about the term consuming, and it really kind of consumption comes with consumption. You know, if you can watch television, oftentimes you're gonna eat or even consume alcohol beverages if you're staying up a little bit later and your body's now out of its normal routine, and people have a habit to want to be doing something while they're watching television. Consumption comes with consumption, and oftentimes people find themselves consuming when they aren't necessarily planning on it. And in fact, a longer history of studies show that watching people consume alcohol or substances on television impacts upon our desire to do that then directly. So any characters that in plots that are maybe occurring around a bar or in a kind of an area where alcohol consumption is happening, it kind of implicitly suggests that this is something for the consumer watching the program now to kind of engage in also, and it can have an influence on how we'd normally spend that time.
We're talking about binge-watching TV with clinical psychologist Ben Rader. He's a public education coordinator for the Wisconsin Psychological Association. Still time for your thoughts. Do you love watching TV for long periods of time? How many hours a day do you watch? Have you kept track? Do you find shows online or do you use a streaming service? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ben, as we said earlier, you know, TV is no longer viewed just on a TV set. There are the computers and the tablets and the phones. So it's very accessible. How does the ease of binge watching shows have an impact on us?
Well, I think that's the crucial factor right now. There's a time where and I can still recall where you had to watch a certain program at a certain time, and you were going to wait an entire week.
You had to have a date with that
that's
hour.
Right. That's right. And you had to wait the full week, and then you're going to watch it, maybe again. And there was a time then where people started maybe videotaping or recording their shows and watching it, you know, later on. But even that meant you had to plan to record it and then come back. Now it's literally at your fingertips. And when a series comes out, of course, all episodes are accessible all at once. So the idea that maybe you're left hanging and there's a plot, a loophole or something that's open in the stories, a continuation, and you've just ended one episode, you can now easily move into the next episode in a way that was never possible in the past.
Do you know whether binge watching is a new problem, or is this something that we've been dealing with for a long time now?
Yeah, I think this has been kind of a disguised problem. It's again nature, human nature 101 somewhat, and that is what we tend to want to continue doing what makes us feel happy and comfortable. And at one point, you may get into that rhythm that you mentioned earlier of now you're feeling more relaxed and you're escaping some degree of anxiety, and the characters that you're kind of watching or following are offering kind of a distraction or maybe even some form of instruction into your own life and circumstances. And it's very reinforcing to be able to just allow yourself to be in that moment. One moment kind of bleeds into the next, and certainly any escapist activity we have can have that impact on us.
And what about that ability to laugh out loud?
Yeah, that's something too that research does show is has some clear benefits, and to be able to and laughing too is something that we tend to do socially, and even when we're alone. You're watching a television program, a laugh track on a show, for instance, kind of suggests you're not alone in your laughter, and you're joining in with the characters, and you're even though you're alone, you're also somehow being social through that laughter. So it becomes something, I think, that that helps us feel a little bit more connected to others and to other people's situations.
Ben, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure once again.
Ben Rader is a clinical psychologist in Milwaukee and the public education coordinator for the Wisconsin Psychological Association, and he joined us from our studios in Milwaukee. Coming up, this is the time of year when we see more algae blooms. We'll talk with a lake ecologist about what the blue-green scum is and how we can deal with it. Are there blooms on your lake or pond? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll talk about toxic blooms after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about blue-green algae blooms on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The summer heat and calm conditions on many lakes can be a recipe for lake scum and algae blooms. And these blooms can make people sick and can make their pets sick if ingested. But not all algae is toxic, so it's a really good time to check in on our water bodies and our wells. Has blue-green algae kept you from your summer activities? Have you or anyone you know gotten sick from an algae bloom? Did your dog get sick after drinking lake water or swimming in a toxic bloom? We're at 800-642-1234. Steve Carpenter is Director Emeritus of the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much, Kate. It's great to be here.
So between 2016 and 2017, we saw the number of toxic algae blooms reported in the U.S. lakes. They spiked, more than tripled, and compared to, you know, data from about a decade ago, they're a lot higher than they used to be. What's behind this trend?
It's the weather and the soil. High levels of phosphorus, which is a fertilizer for the blooms, in many soils around the country. And then you combine that with torrential rains, which wash the soil into the surface water, into the lakes or reservoirs, and then heat. Blue-green algae really like heat. And so the combination of polluted soil, heavy rain, and hot temperatures gives you algae blooms.
Well, let's start with that first one, phosphorus. What do we know about runoff and the impact it has on our water bodies?
Well, we know that phosphorus is the fundamental driver of blooms of algae, including the ones we call blue-green algae. Scientists call those cyanobacteria because they really are bacteria. And I may use the word cyanobacteria inadvertently, but the phosphorus comes. Here in southern Wisconsin, it comes mostly from agriculture because we have state laws that limit application of phosphorus fertilizer to people's lawns. Lawns used to be a big part of the problem, but they are no longer so important as a source of phosphorus.
Oh, wow. So lawns aren't as big of an issue anymore.
Well, it depends on local laws. Here in Dane County, Wisconsin, phosphorus from lawns is not much of a problem. And also there are other municipalities around the country that limit phosphorus in lawn fertilizer. Agriculture needs phosphorus. They need phosphorus fertilizer to grow crops. And also dairy requires a lot of phosphorus. There are substantial amounts of phosphorus in milk. and you have to make sure that dairy cows are getting a lot of phosphorus. That excess phosphorus comes out the other end of the cow as manure, and manure can be eroded into streams and lakes.
We're talking about algae blooms with Steve Carpenter, Director Emeritus of the Limnology Center at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions, your observations, 800-642-1234. Have you lived in Wisconsin for a long time? Do you remember these algae blooms from decades past, or does this seem like a new occurrence to you? What do you observe about the blooms? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. So what makes an algae bloom toxic? How does it become toxic, Steve?
There are certain species of blue-green algae that make toxins, and the toxins are very, very deadly. The common names are things like ultra-fast death factor. And those names give you a cue that you wouldn't want to ingest those. I'm not going to go into the chemistry here on the radio. These are made by the bacteria that make up the blooms. Only certain species can make them, and production of the toxins is associated with hot weather. Later on in the summer, not so much with the cool weather times of the year.
But these blooms can also happen in the winter, it seems. That's not out of the norm.
Well,
or on top of lakes?
In our area, we don't see that. We can get high concentrations of algae under the ice. Those are often diatoms or a kind of algae we call green algae, and green algae really are algae, whereas cyanobacteria are bacteria. I'm not familiar with under ice blooms of toxic cyanobacteria.
When can algae be helpful to a lake?
Well, algae that are not toxic and that are edible are the base of the food chain. So if you have edible algae, you can grow the small animals that are fish food, and you can grow fish.
So what are you seeing this season with these toxic algae blooms? More, less, pretty normal?
You know, I would say that we got some early bloom activity during those heat waves, and now things are fairly normal, at least here in our region. And normal, includes high levels of cyanobacteria. I think that the media attention that we're seeing now is the result of the heat wave from a couple of weeks ago.
How do scientists manage these blooms?
How do we manage them?
Yeah.
Not well. The key is to reduce phosphorus input. You really have to be managing the runoff of phosphorus, and that starts on the land. Here in Wisconsin, Dane County, the county around Madison, is one of the most innovative in managing water pollution. There is a program of manure digesters that digest the manure to a harmless fertilizer cake and release the gases in a form that can be burned to make energy. Dane County has several of those. There has been a program to dredge streams and get the phosphorus out of the streams so we can't go into the lakes. These are examples of things that can be done to reduce phosphorus runoff.
Are those beneficial? Do they work? Dredging?
Well, it's early to say. In theory, they will work. There are places in Europe where those technologies have worked. But, you know, every place is a little different. And this is really experimental management that's going on here in Dane County.
Are urban or rural bodies of water more susceptible to these algae blooms?
It depends on the on the local chemistry. I would say rural or urban doesn't really matter.
Well, looking what happens downstream, what impact can these toxic algae blooms have on downstream as you look toward the Gulf of Mexico and the dead zone in the Gulf?
Well, they are the cause of the dead zone in the Gulf, and the nutrient runoff all along the Missouri and Mississippi river basins is what drives the nutrient inputs to the Gulf and the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
What happens in a dead zone? What do you see in the water?
The production of algae becomes so large that the nighttime respiration of the algae, at night, the algae respire just like you do. And respiration takes up oxygen. At night, the oxygen can go to zero and the animals die. And the attached animals, things like, say, clams or scallops, can't move. They're stuck to the bottom and they just die. Fish in some cases can swim away. But if the dead zone is really large, hundreds of square miles, fish may not be able to swim out of it before they die due to lack of oxygen.
And the dead zone is growing, scientists say. Is that a really big concern?
It's a big concern if you live in a Gulf Coast state, for sure, because it means your fisheries are collapsing. You're losing the recreational economy that goes with the beaches and so on.
We are talking about blue-green algae blooms when nitrogen and phosphorus runoff from farms combined with warm summer weather to create massive blooms of algae in rivers and lakes that can be toxic. Steve Carpenter is our guide. He's Director Emeritus of the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison. Are you a farmer? Do you take measures to decrease runoff? Have you changed your approach over the years? And as a homeowner, have you changed how you treat your lawn? Join into this conversation. Your observations, your questions, welcome. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about toxic algae blooms and the state of our water. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Blue-green algae can produce toxins that threaten drinking water supplies. Toxic blooms happen straight across the country. And in Florida, the Army Corps of Engineers is looking at possible uses for tons of algae, like converting it into biofuel or using it in yoga mats or tennis shoes. Martin Page is with the Army Corps of Engineers Research and Development Center, and he spoke with NPR about how blooms affect water quality downstream in the Gulf.
If there's any community in the country where there's a harmful algal bloom upstream, developing some tools to help them mitigate the impacts on the downstream communities is what we're shooting for.
Do you take measures to decrease runoff? Have you changed your approach to lawn care or treating your fields? Join in with your insights, your questions. Welcome, 800-642-1234. And Steve Carpenter stays with us. He's Emeritus Director of the Limnology Center at UW-Madison. Let's go to the phones now with Terry joining us from Mercer. Hi, Terry.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a couple questions for Steve. One was, I was wondering about the impacts at what level the blue-green algae affects wildlife, either aquatic species or species like ducks and other, even bears or deer that might go into the water. And secondly, I was wondering if he could mention something about, I know the Trout Lake Research Station, which is part of the Limnology Lab, has an open house this Friday, and I'm wondering if they would have programming there for the public on phosphorus.
Aha.
Great questions. The toxic blooms can definitely affect any terrestrial animal, and dogs and people need to be particularly careful, but wildlife could be killed as well. It's common to see dead waterfowl during severe blooms. An extensive bloom a couple of years ago here in Madison, we lost a lot of ducks, and that's unfortunate. But those toxins do affect terrestrial animals.
And so, what about education-wise for phosphorus? What types of education resources are out there?
Well, the websites of the Center for Limnology have a lot of information about phosphorus and cyanobacteria blooms. Limnology.wisc.edu is a good source, and I would suggest that you start there. The caller mentioned the open house at Trout Lake Station, and that is a good way to surround yourself with limnologists. There will be several dozen trained limnologists there to answer your questions at the station. The Trout Lake area is not known for algae blooms. That northern wooded part of the state generally has pretty good water quality, but there will be limnological experts from the Madison lab who are up there and can answer your questions about blooms.
How does the issue of farm runoff affect well water?
That is a really good question. Now, the well water problems are separate from cyanobacteria,
but
well water problems are becoming much more severe in Wisconsin. In southwest Wisconsin, more than 40% of the wells are too toxic to drink due to agricultural pollution. The main toxin, the most famous one that you hear about, is nitrate. Nitrate causes blue baby syndrome. Babies and toddlers lose their ability to process oxygen and asphyxiate and die. So that is a very, very severe problem. And nitrate can also hurt adults. So nitrate in wells above the health standard is a really serious problem. We're also seeing more and more incidents where antibiotic resistant bacteria, human pathogens, are in the well water of rural areas. Antibiotics are used in animal agriculture. Antibiotics make farm animals grow faster, and so it's helpful to use them for that reason. But the use of antibiotics in that way generates antibiotic resistant bacteria that cannot be killed by ordinary antibiotics, and those bacteria are very serious health problems, and those are turning up in wells.
We're talking with Steve Carpenter, Director Emeritus of the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison. We are talking about water quality with him. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Steve, looking closer at agriculture and these toxic blooms that we're seeing more and more from year to year, why are we only seeing these increases now over the past decade if this problem is mostly due to agricultural pollution?
The in recent years, I would say, well, actually, recent decades, since about 1940, our precipitation has been going up in southern Wisconsin, and it's going up slowly and with a lot of variability. But if you look at all the data since 1940, there is a steady increase in precipitation, and more of that precipitation is rain, less of it is snow. And rain can wash soil into lakes, into surface water. So rising precipitation is one factor. Another factor is that we're getting more torrential rains. And again, the data show that the rain we are getting is bundled into bigger storms. And a bigger storm can wash more soil into surface water. I think this makes sense to anybody who's ever, watched a bare piece of ground or watched a crop field during a rainstorm. So more rain, the rain is bundled in bigger storms, and it's warmer.
What happens after a toxic algae bloom? Is it possible to clean it up, or do you just wait until it's cold again and it goes away? The algae dies.
Let me first finish the point about warmer waters. Warmer water selects for cyanobacteria, which are the toxin-producing bloom formers. You asked how to clean them up, and the best thing to do is just wait till they die and let it wash downstream. Once it's in there, there's nothing you can do.
If we could take steps today to help prevent blooms in the future, what would you suggest?
Well, I think it starts, the thing that we control locally is phosphorus pollution, and agriculture is the biggest phosphorus polluter. And I think we need to be working on ideas for containing that phosphorus, essentially sewage treatment for cows and pigs and chickens. And that's the idea behind the manure digesters in Dane County is to essentially handle the manure as if it were sewage and convert it to a byproduct that is not harmful.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you for having me.
Steve Carpenter is the Director Emeritus of the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison. We've been looking at those blue-green algae blooms. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.